Welcome everyone to the Lowy Institute. My name is Roland Rajah. I'm the director of the International Economy Program here at the Institute. Today it's my pleasure to be introducing the day's event to launch the Asian Development Bank's flagship publication, the Asian Development Outlook 2018, which analyzes the economic outlook for the region and includes a special focus on how technology is affecting jobs in Asia. On the economic outlook, the world economy is enjoying a synchronized cyclical upswing for the first time since the GFC around a decade ago. Yet at the same time, the situation is far from benign, in particular with escalating economic tension between the United States and China and the risk of some kind of trade war casting a dark shadow over the region's export-orientated economies. At the same time, there's also the usual concern around the ongoing normalization of US monetary policy and the potential for volatility in financial markets and capital flows to emerging economies. If these are some of the key immediate risks facing the region, then perhaps one of the most pressing longer-term issues is how technology is going to affect jobs in the region, with rapidly advancing technologies like robotics, AI, the Internet of Things, additive manufacturing, threatening to have a very profound impact on the region's economies. All around the world, there is a combination of both high optimism as well as extreme concern about how these new technologies might revolutionize our world. The techno-optimists point to the potential for exponential gains in human living standards and productivity. The techno-pessimists point to the risks of automation, mass job losses, rising inequality, and concerns around how these new technologies are affecting our social and political structures. As powerful as these concerns are for those of us in Western countries, the challenges facing countries in Asia seem to be much more profound. What will these new technologies do to the region's export-orientated industries and economic growth model? What will it mean for the region's workforces? Do they have the skills needed in order to compete? Are their education systems up to the task of equipping people with the right kind of skills that they will need going forward as the world continues to change very rapidly? So these are some of the big questions that I'm hoping that the ADB will be able to shed some light on in their presentation. So let me now introduce our two speakers for the day's event. First, we have Dr. Valerie Mercer-Blackman. She's a senior economist in the Macroeconomics Research Division of the ADB, and she will present on the economic outlook for Asia and on the special theme chapter on technology and jobs. And then we will hear from Dr. Ananya Basu, who's the principal economist at the ADB's Pacific Department, and she will present on the economic outlook for the Pacific Islands region in particular. So let me first please welcome Dr. Mercer-Blackman to the lectern to give her presentation.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ronald. Appreciate it. So this report looks at 45 developing Asia countries. Comes out every year, and as Ronald mentioned, this year the theme chapter is about technology and jobs. So let me get started. First, I will give you the key messages. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to through the presentation relatively quickly, but I will leave a lot of time for questions. So if there's some particular issues of more interest, please. Please keep the questions for then. The key messages of the report are that developing Asia is to continue solid growth of 6% in 2018 and 5.9% in 2019 amidst a strong domestic and external demand. The PRC, People Republic of China, I'll call China from now on, is moderating with greater focus on financial stability, while India is rebounding from temporary reform-related setbacks. China and India are about 70% of the region's GDP. Firming commodity prices and consumer demand will push inflation to 2.9% in 2018 and 2019, but that is still below the 10-year average. And that's from 2.3 in 2017. The key risks to our outlook, to our forecast, stem from escalating trade tensions, as mentioned, also rising U.S. interest rates, and accumulating domestic private debt. And then our theme chapter, which I will go to in more detail later on. But let me just get started. The growth in developing Asia, which is shown in the green bars, was quite high. It was a very good year for the region, 6.1%. Of course, a lot of these numbers are sort of dominated by China, but still it shows this pickup. And growth will be 6% and 5.9%. So there'll be a little bit of a leveling out from the very high base. If we exclude the newly industrialized economies of Korea, Taipei, China, Hong Kong, and Singapore, growth will be 6.6, was 6.6 in 2017, 6.5 in 2018, and 6.4% in 2019. So the same sort of pattern. Synchronized and broad-based growth pickup in 2017 in the major industrial economies in the US, Euro area, and Japan provided a boost to developing Asia's growth and continues to support the outlook. So for our baseline projections, the three economies are expected to grow in total about 2.3 in 2018, about the same amount as in 2017, but a huge growth from 2016, and then level off to 2%. The biggest change there you can see is the United States, which will be is expected to grow 2.7% in 2018, and a lot of this has to do with the very large fiscal expansion that is occurring in an economy that is already very much in full employment. And for the Euro area and Japan, consumer and business confidence continues to be very high since the beginning of the year, so we expect that these sorts of numbers will continue for 2018 and then level off in 2019. So the real sort of crux of the growth in 2017 was a synchronized trade resurgence. Strong external demand led to robust pickup of trade. There was a pickup in both volumes and prices. The trade pickup was broad-based across products and synchronized across countries. Both charts show recovery from the general trade contraction that began in 2015. In the left panel shows growth in nominal exports, exceeding expectations from what we thought at the beginning of last year, driven by manufacturing goods that are highly interlinked within developing Asia. Also, higher commodity prices spurred export growth for commodity exporting economies, not just in oil, but also metals and raw materials. And then the right panel shows growth in nominal imports driven by buoyant demand for primary and manufacturing goods. Actually, the real growth spurt started in the fourth quarter of 2016. And this is going to be expected to continue to a more modest pace. You can see here some of the, in the left panel, the largest economies. You can see the rebound in exports, and it will continue to be positive, but a slightly lower pace, slope. Many products will experience a high growth are high technology electronics with components such as sensors, memories, and logic integrated circuits, with broad applications such as medical, automobile, and transport leading the way. So you can see here, first of all, that Asia still has the biggest share of semiconductors and is expected to grow in 2018. However, the integrated circuits, which is sort of the more basic types of semiconductors, are actually going to drop by half, and some of the other products will continue to expand. So we're beginning to see sort of less of a sort of a semiconductor cycle, which used to occur a lot depending on products, and we're beginning to see a much more ubiquitous set of products being produced. Much of the impetus for developing Asia's growth came from the unexpectedly consumption growth drivers. We believe consumption growth drivers will continue to play an important role in the forecast period. Consumer confidence, as both panels indicate, will continue to go up in most countries. This chart here shows the domestic demand really driving the growth, even in 2017. So you can see the orange parts of the bars, which show consumption growth, investment in green, which a lot of it going into manufacturing investment, whereas net exports, this is in real terms, in some countries produce a turnaround, especially in China, which is here on the left. But in many other countries, because the domestic demand was so high, import demand was even higher than exports. And so therefore, you see that there was actually a negative, or net exports actually subtracted from growth. Here is just sort of a summary of our forecasts for the region in terms of where we see things going. I'll go through this very quickly. Of course, on the Pacific, my colleague Ananya will go into much more detail. For East Asia, of course, China dominating, but also you see some of the other countries, the newly industrialized economies, having a very big pickup in 2017, which will sort of level off in 2018 and 2019. In Southeast Asia, many of the ASEAN countries, you see some countries also have a big, such a big growth spurt, especially the ones that are more dependent on trade, actually level off for 2018 and 2019, but Philippines, Thailand, and Indonesia are expected to have very, very large public investment programs especially. So that will push their growth up more in 2018 compared to 2017. So overall for the region, the growth rate will be 5.2%. South Asia, I'll go into India in a minute, but because there's some recovery in India, that will also be the fastest growing region in Asia, and possibly the world. And Central Asia, and these are not all the economies, of course, these are just the bigger ones. So in the case of Central Asia, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, the big oil producers, will continue to grow with high oil prices, but all other sectors are also expanding. A little bit about China. We expect a sustained moderation in favor of reforms in terms of growth. You can see here that consumption really, on the demand side, consumption really added to growth the most. Out of the 6 percentage points, it was the biggest. And this is the way that they're looking for it. So there's been a lot of the policies have been to move away from this sort of export-led model of growth towards more internal domestic demand-driven growth. And they're very much succeeding in that regard. Again, the pickup of exports was high enough in 2017 to actually raise it more than was expected. But over the long term, you can see this sort of leveling off of growth, a slight moderation into sort of lower but more stable rates. So 2018 and 2019, we're expecting that to continue, that this long-term slightly downward trend to continue. Growth will dampen over the government's priorities are three. First, to head off financial crisis and try to ensure that the financial sector is as stable as possible. Controlling environmental pollution, and a lot of this is being done by the growth and services sector. In fact, if you look at it from the supply side, about two-thirds of this growth was due to services sector growth. And third, targeted intervention to eliminate poverty, which includes sort of reducing the disparities between rural and urban incomes in some cases. On the other hand, India's growth in fiscal year 2017 declined from the previous year on lingering effects of the demonetization in 2016 and the goods and services tax implementation last year, which temporarily undercut consumer and producer confidence. Growth is expected to bounce back to 7.3% in 2018 and firm to 7.6% in 2019. As a new tax regime and some of the other reforms that have been going on have really improved productivity. And as banking reforms and corporate deleveraging take hold to reverse the downtrend in investment, making India the fastest growing economy for 2018. So we really feel that effective structural reform in the past 2 years is going to help catalyze this long-term sustained growth. Commodity prices, we have a projection for oil prices to be 65% in 2018 and 62% in 2019. Future prices are looking at a number somewhere below 60, but for example, now the latest number is that oil prices or Brent crude prices are somewhat slightly below $70, and there was a lot of volatility and certainly higher increase than expected last year. Two reasons. One is the OPEC supply cuts will be maintained through 2018, but also the very large boost in global demand for oil also helped raise those prices. In terms of food prices, as you know, food is a very important part of the Asian consumption basket, and we expect that these prices to be somewhat more stable, 1.2 percentage points, percent growth in 2018 and 2019. So this will lead to higher inflation for 2018 from the 2.3% that we had in 2017. We expect it to be 2.9% because of mostly commodity prices. However, this is still way below the 3.7% 10-year average. So we believe that inflationary expectations in Asia are well anchored. What are the risks to this outlook? The risk, they are mostly on the downside after a robust and strong growth. So really 2017 was a very good year for Asia's economy. So any risk is going to probably reduce that going forward because the momentum seems to continue. In particular, risks to trade are high with the recent escalation in trade tensions. So far, these have not made a discernible dent in buoyant trade to and from developing Asia. But further U.S. tariff actions and retaliatory moves from partners could undermine the region's outlook. The way this is going to be is mostly by affecting consumer and business confidence, which are really driving the expectations that we think of consumption and investment going forward, and sever a lot of the very tightly knit supply chains in Asia. Another risk is a sudden capital flow reversal arising from faster than expected U.S. interest rate hikes. And as I say, there is a possibility that the U.S. economy, to avoid overheating and to avoid higher inflation, the Federal Reserve will have to have more rapid interest rate hikes of what is already built into the projection. And this could lead to an outflow, a possible capital, rapid capital outflow from Asia. The third less likely risk is the impact of rising private debt on economic growth. Private debt in Asia rose after the global financial crisis, but our analysis fails to find a positive relationship between private debt growth and economic growth beyond the short term. Hence, what is important is the quality of debt that should be pushed, and debt trends do closely have to be monitored while building more effective financial systems. But despite these risks, we believe that improved fiscal and financial positions bolster development, and Asia is very much resilient to these shocks. 2017 has allowed to build up some new buffers in that regard. So we really think the region should take advantage of the current good times to continue to deepen structural reforms that otherwise would be difficult to impose. So moving on to our theme chapter, how technology affects growth, and sort of looking more into the long term, as a foundation of overall resilient growth, developing Asia created jobs for its workers very successfully in the last 10, 25 years. Taking a longer horizon, for 25 years, over the past 25 years, the region has generated 30 million jobs annually outside of agriculture. And job creation has come with improved productivity, rising earnings for workers, and large reductions in poverty. A large part of productivity gains come from the technological advances within sectors, such as the adoption of high-yielding crop varieties in agriculture, modern machine tools in manufacturing, and information and communications technology in services. Having said that, there is growing concern, as mentioned by Ronald, of course, that many jobs are at risk due to the sophistication of robotics and AI technologies, so we try to look at this in more depth in the chapter. As you know, the advent of the fourth industrial revolution, according to the World Economic Forum, is here, is upon us. So looking at it from perspective, if you look at some of, you read some of the history of, about labor productivity, this is not new, right? Very much in the first industrial revolution, high yield crops and tractors really changed. The idea of an urban environment was created. In the second industrial revolution, modern machine tools and the mass production driven by electricity, and based on division of labor, as a result of modern machine tools, really increased labor productivity. In the third industrial revolution, which is time from 1970 to the present, extensive use of information technology and electronics for automation really changed the environment. And the biggest perhaps was computer and internet really joining the globe together. And now we have the fourth industrial revolution, and we already are beginning to see some of the effects on that, which is really joining what could be physical production with virtual production or remote. And actually, this is creating havoc for trying to measure national accounts, because people, it's very difficult to measure some of the productivity being created by these new technologies. That was an aside point. What do we find in the report? We feel that there are compelling reasons to remain optimistic in developing Asia about job prospects. And there are four basic reasons. I'm going to go through them each one at a time. The first is that new technologies tend to automate only some tasks of a job. The second is that technical feasibility does not guarantee economic feasibility. The third is that rising incomes and demand also are helping employment. And fourth are that new occupations and industries are being created. This is a picture that shows that new technologies often involve automating specific tasks associated with a job, not the job in its entirety. And this is a summary. There's been lots of literature coming out, and the report summarizes some of it in a nice table discussing this aspect, especially in advanced economies like the U.S. and Europe. And there was one of the papers that started was a paper by Frey and Osborne, and this is sort of the illustration of that paper, which is that All jobs are basically a series of tasks. And to the extent that your job has more routine tasks as a share of total, then your job is more likely to be in the risk of, risk of automation. So we look at the top quadrant, top left quadrant, cognitive routine jobs, such like an accountant and a bank teller. You have data collection jobs, where you have 64% of their aspect being routine, as well as data processing about the same. Manual routine jobs, such as assembly line workers or sewing machine operators, would have a very large percentage, more than three quarters of their job part of routine tasks. So they're the most at risk of automation. And then at the bottom, you have jobs where you have to manage others and when you have to apply expertise, the lowest. And then, of course, non-routine jobs, would be things we have to deal with customers or perhaps you have unpredictable physical work. And the first studies that came out said, well, then that means that all of the ones on the top are just going to disappear. But we actually find in Asia that this is not the case. And the best way to explain it is a bank teller. When ATM machines arrived, everybody thought that bank tellers would be out of business, and some of them may have been, but you did find that what it meant is that a bank teller can now spend more time, instead of counting money, on customer relations. So this is an example of what we expect, that the jobs themselves are going to be moving towards areas where they can maybe have to deal with more with people and less with the things that robots or other types of automation can do better. The second thing is that industrial robots are concentrated in capital-intensive sectors where employment shares are relatively small. And this is the point made about just because something is technically feasible, just because something can be done by a robot, does not necessarily mean that it can that it's going to be done, at least in the near future. Here's an example of the manufacturing, the shares of manufacturing employment and total manufacturing by sectors. And you can see that the first two sectors, electronics, electrical and electronic equipment and automotive sector, only comprise about 13% of employment in manufacturing employment in Asia, yet they're the ones that are using this is demand for robots. Yet they're the ones that are doing robotics. So robots are better at metals and they do things faster. Whereas at the other end, textiles, apparel and leather, and foods and beverages, which are the majority of employment in manufacturing, are still more cost effective being done by humans than by machines. I'm sorry. The third part, and I think this is the most interesting analysis that came out, is that rising demand offsets displacement driven by automation. So by raising productivity, automation allows a given output to be produced by fewer workers. Thus, new technologies can be job displacing. However, because productivity also lowers costs and prices, it can lead to higher demand, output, and incomes. Does this actually happen? Well, we use 12 economies, which comprise 90% of employment in the region, and decompose changes in employment between 2005 and 2015 into different components. The component capturing the effect of technological advances, holding other components constant, shows a notional 66% decrease in employment, equal to 101 million jobs per annum. So this is sort of the bad news of the story. However, higher demand for goods and services associated with higher incomes more than offsets this, with a notional 88% increase in employment during that period, that decade, equal to 134 million jobs per annum. A third very small component, about 2%, captures the relocation of tasks across countries, something that's called offshoring a lot of the times. It shows a 2% increase. Thus, we find strong support for the idea that rising demand offsets displacement driven by automation of new technologies. Crucially, it is higher domestic demand that is the key, which is the orange, not foreign domestic demand. The countervailing force of higher demand associated with rising incomes is very much at work across the region. Here, we show results for manufacturing only, but once again, technological advances are associated with reductions in employment, but rising demand is a strong countervailing force pushing employment up. So we'll talk a little bit about the different countries, but for example, you look at a country like Korea. Demand driven by rising global incomes is an important source of employment growth in manufacturing. And this is not surprising, right, given Korea's role as a in this global supply chain of manufacturing products. The next reason to be less worried, or the fourth reason to be less worried, is that technology leads to new occupations. But these do tend to be in the non-routine category. Technological change and economic growth create, for example, in the second industrial revolution, or third, auto repair workers and car salesmen emerged alongside the car industry in the 1900s. And more recently, software engineers and app developers accompanied the development of ICT, and there's data on this. In addition, the growing complexity of modern production and life itself is a countervailing force against job losses in technology as it creates new occupations. When we divide these occupations by job type, you remember the graph I showed you before with the different quadrants, most of the new job titles have emerged in the cognitive and non-cognitive category. For example, in the case of Malaysia, 82% of these jobs are in this category, while in India and the Philippines, around 60% of new jobs. It is important to note that even in routine manual jobs, there has been an increase in new occupations. And this part is very much the result of what I told you before, which was the fact that when you can produce something more efficiently, that lowers the price of that good, but it also raises the income of the people who helped in the production. Those people will in turn demand those products more, and that will create new employment. So that's that's lifting all boats as well, but some a little bit more than others. Which leads me to the next point, which is wages have also grown more for these workers. And unfortunately leaving low-skilled workers behind. So demand for jobs that require non-routine cognitive tasks has grown faster. A detailed analysis that we have in Selected Asia's economy show that over the past decade, employment in jobs intensive in non-routine cognitive tasks, social interaction, and the use of ICT expanded 2.6 percentage points faster than total employment. As shown in the chart, average monthly real wages for non-routine cognitive jobs have increased more than those for manual jobs. And these are the countries for which we have very good data. So given these trends, without adequate skills, development or retraining workers with weakened foundation skills face hurdles in seizing the opportunities that new technologies provide. And here I can tell you we have a lot of case studies and there's the business processing outsourcing, which is the Philippines is a big producer. There's a lot of call centers in the Philippines. There are three levels of that. One is, for example, just very simple respond to customers, so call centers. A second, more sophisticated level is perhaps accounting, helping with graphics and data. And a third might be nurses or interpreting medical data or legal data that is brought from other countries. And the industry itself has already announced that the jobs at the bottom category are actually going to go down in the next by quite a bit in the next few years. And the reason for that is that artificial intelligence has allowed some of those simple customer service calls to be done by machines, by robots. So what are the challenges then for the governments? Well, government have an important role to play in leveraging technological advances. And these three things have to work together. You have to have the response to technology, to the changes due to technology, how to use technology better, and support for technology growth. In the first case, you have, of course, education and training. But it's not just the usual spend more on education. Here you have sort of two components. Workers of the future have to be people that have very good, obviously, basic general education. But they have to be people that know how to unlearn things and relearn them throughout their career or their work. So the training actually, ironically, has to be more specific to the job. So people, when they get to a new job, have to be able to know how they do that. But they also have to carry those skills so that that will teach them to do something that might change very quickly. What does that mean for people who are maybe displaced at the moment? It means that maybe things like unemployment insurance has to start being created for informal sector as well, so that people have that time to really take up new training, look for more opportunities, and they don't have to worry about feeding their family, so they have a little bit of a buffer. Social protection and tax policies in general also have to improve. And in terms of provisioning of public goods and services, this will also continue to be, because infrastructure has been what has helped, for example, the internet and many of the manufacturing sectors grow. So in countries where, for example, electricity provision is very good, they tend to have more high-tech manufacturing. This is a summary, again, of the key messages of our report. I'm not going to read them all out for you, but I will repeat the last one, which is that new technologies are not likely to cause widespread losses in Asia. Nevertheless, policy action is needed for workers to overcome challenges posed by technological advance and harness its full benefits. Thank you very much.
Hi everyone, I'm Ananya Basu from the Pacific Department of the Asian Development Bank. I would like to thank Ronald for the introduction and Valerie for her presentation. And I will be going into a little more detail about the 14 developing member countries of the Pacific that ADB works with. The key messages for the Pacific part of the report: the Pacific did not do as well as the rest of Asia did, unfortunately, last year. Economic growth in the Pacific weakened further from 2.4% in 2016 to 2.2% in 2017 for our 14 countries. And this is the slowest it has been since the 2008-09 crisis. We are projecting a recovery, but it's going to be a slow recovery. In the next year, we expect growth to stay at around 2.2%. And then it will rise, we expect, to about 3% in 2019. Uncertainty clouds the near-term outlook. We have various economic drivers like the regional processing center in Nauru winding down activities. Palau, tourism from China is at risk. In Samoa, one of the largest private sector employers has closed operations in 2018. We've already had disasters. It's only April actually, and we've already had disasters in Tonga, in Cyclone Gita, as well as in Papua New Guinea in the form of the earthquake, and political uncertainties are still going on in Timor-Leste. A reversal of fortunes. If you look at the growth in the past few years, it's always been driven by Papua New Guinea, which is not a surprise. It is the largest economy in the Pacific that we work with. And the Pacific growth rates are actually, the average growth rates for us are actually driven totally by the Papua New Guinea factor. As you can see, if you exclude, the green line is the Pacific excluding PNG, that's kind of been flat all through. But Papua New Guinea peaked in 2014, and the average growth for the region also peaked in 2014. And after that, with oil and gas production and revenues dissipating, Papua New Guinea's growth has gone down, which has pulled down growth in the rest of the region. This is an interesting graph in that it shows what we look at now as an end of two-speed growth, as we like to call it. The larger economies, again driven by Papua New Guinea, were growing quite rapidly in 2014, even 2015. But by 2017, our four groups of countries that we have, the North Pacific, the South Pacific, the larger countries, and the small islands, they've all converged to around the 2 to 3% growth rates. Just on the small islands group includes Nauru, so you see the high growth rate in 2013 due to the phosphate exports in Nauru. Let me go a little bit into detail. Before that, just on the external economic environment, Valerie has already presented on that. I won't go into detail, but the external environment we think is reasonably positive for the Pacific countries. And the major partners, Australia, New Zealand, US, PRC to a lesser extent, the outlook is mostly positive, so we expect the external environment will be quite okay. Going now into a little more detail about the 14 countries, and we'll begin, of course, with our largest country, which is Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea's growth in 2017 actually increased a little bit from 2016. It was 2% in 2016, increased a little bit, improved mining output, global metal prices. But we still see risks due to the fiscal consolidation that is going on in the economy at the moment. And of course, as I said earlier, early in 2018, they've been hit by this earthquake, which is going to impact LNG and mining output, which is going to pull down growth in 2018 even below 2.2%. Some positive outlook, of course, comes from the 2018 APEC meetings, some preparations for the 2018 APEC meetings, which is going to lead to some increase in construction and in domestic investment. And by 2019, we project at the moment that There will be a rebound of growth to 2.7% in 2019 as oil and gas production, which has been suspended, returns to full production or close to full production. And also post-earthquake reconstruction is also going to be pulling up growth by 2019. Fiscal consolidation is a good thing, but it's a risk to the outlook because till about 2012, PNG was running balanced budgets, and 2012, 2013 onwards, the fiscal deficit actually went up as resource revenues fell. At the same time, there were greater expenditures, health and education subsidies increased, public office rentals increased, greater wages, and the deficits between 2013 and 2016 were actually in the range of 4 to 7%. Even in 2017, we were projecting, initially at one point, projecting a deficit of 3.8%. It's actually come in now at 2.5% because the new government cut capital expenditures quite a bit. A new medium-term fiscal strategy has been adopted by the government. It has ambitious targets in that it aims to keep the deficit below 2.5% in 2018 and to cut it to 1% by 2022. Quite a lot depends on revenues, tax revenues, domestic revenues. The government is adopting measures to improve tax compliance, tax administration using IT services, the fourth industrial revolution, if you like. The government is also aiming to control the wage bill growth to about 5% annually. And they are also expecting higher dividends and transfers from SOEs. There are risks to this outlook. If these conditions all hold, then the fiscal deficit should be going down. Turning now to Timor-Leste, this is an economy which did not have a good year at all last year. The non-oil economy contracted for the first time in 2017, for the first time in 10 years after growing fairly rapidly before that. This is largely the effect of the elections last year. We had presidential elections in March, parliamentary elections in June. Coalition government came into power. It was a fragile coalition. The five-year program, spending program of the new government was rejected by parliament, actually. And this has affected both public investment and private investment in the economy. Tourism, of course, has done a little better than it did in 2016. The political economy factors still persist. We did see last year a huge decrease in capital investments. Recurrent spending also fell. But we project at the moment, if there is a decisive result in the elections that is coming up later in May this year, we do expect growth to recover to 3% in 2018 and further again to 5.5% in 2019. Large private investment projects are also coming online. There's the Tibarwe port project complex, which has secured its environmental license recently. Hotel and apartment complexes, construction is beginning outside Delhi. Agriculture is expecting to pick up again due to good rains. The long-term prospects for oil and gas is good. Australia and Timor have recently signed a treaty that paves the way for the Greater Sunrise oil and gas field development. This is probably going to come into production only in the 2020s, but at least it improves the outlook for the sector and also increases the prospects for fiscal sustainability. So things are expecting to improve for Timor-Leste. We do see one major challenge in that formal employment is very low. It's only 7.7% of working age population in 2016. And we, in the report itself, we have called for more supportive public policies needed for including supporting labor mobility to work in the European Union and also skills development more proactively. Turning to Fiji. Fiji is an economy which had a very good year last year, but that was largely because in 2016, growth had fallen to about 0.4% just because of Cyclone Winston. So reconstruction has driven growth in 2017. Agriculture has recovered. Tourist arrivals are at a record high. Sugar production has rebounded. Consumption is very strong. We've had remittances going up, new vehicle sales going up, commercial bank lending for consumption has gone up, fiscal deficit has gone down. All in all, a good year for Fiji, largely led by tourism. Going forward, though, we expect, as the reconstruction winds down a little bit, we expect growth to go down marginally, not by a whole lot. And we see a return to more broad-based growth. So not just construction driving growth, but also contributions from agriculture, wholesale and retail trade, and manufacturing. Tourism, of course, is expected to remain a key driver of growth in Fiji. Various private investment projects, hotel complexes, etc., are ongoing and boosting growth. New direct flights to Japan have been introduced that has helped tourism. Expanded services to Singapore and San Francisco have also helped. In the report, we, especially in the aftermath of Cyclone Winston, we have called for climate resilient urban infrastructure to safeguard longer-term growth, and Fiji is taking steps to improve the climate resilience of its infrastructure. Solomon Islands did reasonably well last year. Logging activity has fallen off slightly from the peak of 2016. The output has gone down about 2%. Exports have also gone down 5.5%. And this has led to GDP growth easing a little bit, but contributions from other sectors like agriculture, mining, construction, tourism has been fairly solid. With logging moderating a little bit, we expect growth moderation to continue over the near term. Not by much. We project from 3.2 going down to 3% over the next couple of years. Lower logging contribution, we expect it to be offset partly by mining. Nickel and bauxite output expected to go up. And also we expect construction with the rehabilitation of the Gold Ridge gold mine, the Tena River hydropower development project, and also undersea cable project that will contribute to growth continuing in 2019. There are some risks to the outlook in case these construction projects get delayed, but overall right now we are projecting 3%. One risk, of course, is the slowdown in China also, as China is a key market for Solomon Islands exports. In the report, we have called for a need to go into transition into more sustainable sources of growth, not just depending on logging, which there is some sustainability. There are some questions around the sustainability of logging. Improving transport connectivity, we say in the report that's very important to boost growth. And the government has actually come up with a national transport plan identifying the priority investments. The only catch is that the priority investments themselves add up to more than 2016 GDP itself. So the government will need to work with development partners, hopefully go for more concessional financing, better coordination to try and finance these priority investments. In the graph, as you can see, the tourism has gone up. This was also largely because 2017 was the 75th anniversary of the Guadalcanal landing during the Second World War. This had led to greater tourism, and especially by cruise ships. Turning now to Vanuatu, which is also one of our larger economies in the Pacific. Economic recovery has continued. In 2015, it had been hit by the cyclone Pam. Growth had gone down, as you can see. In 2015, it had suffered quite a bit. But it's now, again, it's gone up to 3.5%. And this is basically in the aftermath of the cyclone. Basically, it's been driven by reconstruction. Growth is expected to moderate a little bit in Vanuatu as these reconstruction projects are completed. And ambitious infrastructure push that the government has right now also needs to be balanced, though, with prudent fiscal management. The IMF is projecting Vanuatu's public and publicly guaranteed debt to almost double in percentage terms from 2016 to 2021 because of this infrastructure push. So that, we think, Vanuatu needs to be a little careful about. Domestic revenue mobilization in Vanuatu is weak even by Pacific standards, and the government is taking steps to improve its revenue base. The value-added tax has been raised recently to 15% from 12.5%, and the government is also talking about increasing or actually introducing income taxes, although we don't have a formal timeline for it yet. But basically, in our report, we call for the government to balance these revenue mobilization efforts with supporting the private sector, since value-added taxes and import tariffs may have adverse effects on the private sector. Moving to our three economies in the North Pacific, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and Palau. Micronesia and Marshall Islands did reasonably well last year due to project implementation, including partner finance projects. Palau, the economy contracted to with a growth rate of negative 0.5%. This was largely due to the El Nino, continuing effects of El Nino in Palau. The Jellyfish Lake, which is one of their famous tourist attractions, has closed down, and tourism has contracted severely in Palau over the last couple of years, and especially from China. The tourism from China has fallen, so GDP growth in Palau has contracted. FSM and Micronesia expected to continue in the 2 to 3% range even next year. Palau, we are hoping to see a bigger recovery, at least into positive growth, and private investment in new hotels and public infrastructure projects funded by partners is picking up. Recovery of tourism, of course, in Palau could be still constrained, as PRC has imposed restrictions on advertisements for group tours not formally approved by the government. But overall, we are projecting at the moment cautiously a positive expansion in Palau in 2017. In the report, we have looked a little bit at education quality in these three countries, especially teaching quality. And teaching quality we find especially in Micronesia and Marshall Islands. Most teachers do not meet, more than 50% of teachers in both countries do not meet the minimum qualifications required for teaching. And ADB is actually last year is helping out with a project combining Micronesia and Marshall Islands to help on teacher training and better student achievements. This project was approved last year. South Pacific, we have our three countries, Cook Islands, Samoa, and Tonga. Both, all three depending largely on tourism. Cook Islands has seen quite a moderation of growth from 2016 to 2017 as infrastructure projects winded down. Samoa growth also has slowed a little because large capital projects have been neared completion. All the three countries, we in the report, we look at the need to consider the impact of tourism, to promote sustainable tourism, especially since all these countries are quite prone to the effects of natural disasters. Tonga, of course, was hit by Cyclone Geeta earlier this year. We are expecting a contraction in 2018 for the economy as a whole. And the government is also looking to contain the government wage bill, which has been growing pretty rapidly over the last few years. All these three countries have taken advantage of ADB's lending program and have taken contingent financing for disaster resilience. Tonga actually drew that down. This is basically, we approve loans for these three countries, and the money basically just sits there. They don't draw it down, and only when there's a disaster do they draw it down. So there is no delay. In case a disaster strikes, they can draw down the funds immediately. Cook and Samoa have not had to use it yet. Tonga has used it already earlier this year when Cyclone Geeta hit, and we were able to disperse funds to Tonga within 24 hours of the receipt of the government's request, which is quite speedy by our standards, definitely, and it gave the government funds to draw down on for immediate disaster response. And finally, to our small islands, Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Nauru. Nauru, the economy is actually slowing down quite a bit because of two factors. One is the regional processing center, which is the asylum seekers facility run by Australia. They are activities there are drawing down. Phosphate exports also not doing very well. So Nauru, the economy is expecting to contract a little bit. Kiribati and Tuvalu, the growth is moderating. Fishing revenue receipts are also moderating. And these factors together have resulted in fairly slow growth in all three economies. In the report, we recommend that the government take steps to improve transport connectivity because, as you can see, these economies are really very scattered. Maybe not Kiribati so much, but Tuvalu and Nauru, the ratio of the land area to the exclusive economic zone is quite high, even by Pacific standards. So the transport connectivity factor is important. Kiribati is undertaking SOE reforms in the shipping for shipping, and they've acquired two new vessels and also developing a longer-term strategy for corporate sustainability of the fleet. Nauru, with funding from ADB support, is about to embark on the construction of a new climate-resilient seaport, because right now the Nauru seaport has to be closed about 3 months in the year. And Tuvalu also, we are recommending and supporting them to provide better marine transport infrastructure, because the small ferries, it's serviced mainly by small ferries rather than by large ships, because the seaport is like that. So basically, this is the gist of the Pacific outlook, and I'll stop here, and we can have any questions.
Thanks, Ananya. We have a few minutes left for questions and answers. I might kick it off by asking what might be maybe a slightly difficult question for you, Valerie, which is maybe obviously there are major challenges ahead in terms of the impact of technology on the workforce and jobs in Asia. The key question to my mind is, you know, are Asian policymakers actually up to the task of responding to this? I mean, if you look at some of the policy suggestions and recommendations that you've made, things around spending more on social security, education being very important, of course, competition policy, these kinds of things. A, it takes a long time to put these systems in place. B, when it comes to things like education, actually there's a long pipeline effect, right? It takes a whole generation to shift for these new, better skilled people to actually enter the workforce. And then at the same time, of course, you know, the technology is moving very fast and the changes are coming very quickly. So it's a difficult question to ask, are the policymakers actually up to the task of responding quickly? A more easier to answer question might be, do you actually see progress being made in many of these most important fronts in some of the countries?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it's a million-dollar question, of course. And one of the things that is different about the fourth industrial revolution than the others is that it's going to come very quickly. So the reaction has to be equally fast. And I think certainly to the extent that workers are being expected to have a different mindset, I think that governments are going to have to do so. One of the things is, for example, that many of the policies, not just in Asia, but in most countries, are for formal employment, for wage and formal employment. And a lot of these economies, a lot of these technologies are actually helping the informal sector. For example, there's a very interesting box about e-commerce and about how a lot of the growing e-commerce that is occurring in Asia is occurring through Facebook and Instagram and some of these, through these medias. So there are some things that probably we don't know what to do, but I think it's not so much, and I agree with you that there is a challenge that these things are happening very quickly, and maybe even if there wasn't this change, Asia would still be behind some of these issues, especially social security. So I think the question here is, just like there's going to need to be a change in mindset, I think the government is going to have to be thinking about doing things in a different way. So in the area of technology, full collaboration with the private sector, I mean, they have to be very much part of it. In Malaysia, for example, they are instituting digital free trade zones and for small businesses to actually be able to do these things. But on the other hand, they also have to see how there will be people that will suffer, and this group of people, and try to hone in the sort of supportive policies towards those. And in terms of education, the good news on that is that because of internet access and because of a more globalized place, then it will be easier for people to get informed about certain things. It's not like in the past where only the few who could afford were getting the education and knowledge, whereas others were not. So that's the positive side of it too. But it's I'm sure there's much more to do.
Thanks, Valerie. Might open it up, see if there's any questions from the floor. Yes, Alex.
Alexander Dion from the Institute. So I have two questions. One for Valerie. Well, we said that technology is increasing productivity, and so productivity might increase wealth for like private companies, right? And when we talk about technology, sometime on the social aspect, we talked about universal income. And I wanted to know if the ADB considered the universal income spread around Asia as a solution to maybe help the workers who are in this transitional phase from like finding work that doesn't exist anymore because of technology to get a new one. So that was my first question. And second question for Dr. Basu, what is the impact of technology on the labor market in the Pacific? Yeah, that's very broad. Good luck.
On your question, we have seen that these are some of the proposals but it's very much the idea of universal income very much goes to the extent of it. For example, I discussed that one of the things about labor regulation has to be much less rigid, And there are some countries, for example, where high severance payments and make things that make it difficult for to, I don't want to say hire and fire anymore, but certainly to have more flexibility in the workplace. The policies are still not taking that into account. So policies themselves have to be more flexible, have to sort of adjust to the flexibility. But the one about income is very true. I mean, there are different ways of doing it, of course. What we find in Asia is that there's unemployment rates are very low, but some sub-employment is very high. In other words, there's a large group of people that are working not as many hours as they would like to or are able to work. And so those are mostly in the informal sector, and it's very difficult to get to them. So anything like this, any sort of system, employment benefits, that can get to that could have large improvements. But I think more importantly, it's getting to this transition part. So there's a short-term transition when a factory is closed because robots take over something. This transition, governments have not been very good at dealing with. There's been a bit of a blame game as opposed to just understanding that this is happening and that people need a buffer as they move on.
On the labor market in the Pacific, I mean, we see very limited short-term effects. The fourth industrial revolution still hasn't come to many Pacific countries in a big way. Palau got its internet through an ADB project last year. So before that, there was no internet in the country, right? So it's going to be a lot slower, I think, and you can come in. It's going to be a lot slower than in the other countries. Where we do see some effects would be migration. If there are job opportunities available elsewhere, and if the public policies are supportive, they could migrate to, you know, EU countries or America or things. But in the short term, the Pacific is still very much, they're still laying their undersea submarine cables to bring the internet to the countries, to bring strong internet to the countries. We do have internet, but Marshall Islands, for example, there was something went wrong with the cable, and for 3 months the country's internet was out. So in this situation, we are still not thinking of major effects on the labor markets yet.
One very large industry and sector in Pacific Islands is tourism. And actually, tourism is one of the sectors that it will probably benefit because the kinds of jobs there are, as in the language I was talking about, non-cognitive, non-routine jobs. And any job that is may require emotional intelligence, may require dealing with customers, these sorts of things are actually going to increase because humans are still better than that robot. So to that extent, and the long term looks a little bit better, but of course, in some ways, they're still in the third industrial revolution in the islands for other reasons. So,
hi, I'm Charlie from the Lowy Institute. Yesterday, Xi Jinping announced at the Boao Forum that China would start enforcing the theft of foreign companies' intellectual property, and that tariffs on automobiles would be reduced. Beyond these reforms, what other more structural reforms should China implement if it's to make a successful transition to a consumption-driven growth model?
Right. Well, China has been very successful, right? In fact, the largest demand for robotics in anywhere in the world is still China, and they have been moving through innovation. Now, the issue of whether it's tariffs or whether tariffs are going to stop, the way we see tariffs is that tariffs are mostly going to just reduce trade. A region of the world that is so dependent on trade, it's not good news. It's not good news for innovation, it's not good news for everything. So as I mentioned, for the outlook, there have been some tariffs that have been put in. That's fine. A lot of the new tariffs, and again, this is still very much in the proposal and back and forthing, so we don't know what will come in, what won't, what they'll negotiate, etc. But a lot of these tariffs seem to be directed at doing things that tariffs are not very good at doing, and sometimes actually having the opposite effect. So to the extent that, for example, one of the things, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the U.S. withdrew off very, very early on, was supposed to be a way to allow other parts of Asia, including their links with the U.S. and Europe, to be able to prosper and to improve, better sharing of ideas. And Asia itself, even though the U.S. will not be part of it, want to continue on that. There's going to actually be 11 countries have already ratified that they will try to have their own sort of thing. And there's a lot of ASEAN also has a lot of opportunities for migration and for opening markets. So I think very much Asia is still in the we want to open markets. We want to develop in a way that will open markets and that will improve innovation. There are issues and pockets of this and that, but I think that that's the other aspect overwhelmingly brings that out, I think.
Hi, Ian Lin, I'm from Quo Vadis. The Chinese Belt and Road Initiative could have a lot of effect in these countries we're talking about. And in fact, it's getting quite political as far as Australia is concerned about what that will do. In your research work, how do you take into account these major new things that are really going to go ahead now?
In the first part of the report, I mentioned there's a lot of investment that we're expecting to happen and already is happening in many of these countries. For example, Malaysia, Hong Kong, you actually see these very large projects that are part of this Belt and Road Initiative that are going to be contributing, for example, to that. So, for example, there's the East-West rail link in Malaysia is part of this initiative, and that will contribute. So the way that we look at it is basically this is an initiative that China has. It has already been raising some of the investment. We see the investment projects actually happening, and therefore we account for those investment projects in the projections. So that's the way we see it. I mean, in terms of we don't have any political view on it, but certainly on the economic view, it's very much happening and it's been included in the projections.
To me, in the South Pacific Islands area, the effect that it might have, because it would be so great compared to their present economies, okay, could totally change some of these figures you're giving us. Do you take that into account?
We do take into account the effects of uncertain things. But in this particular case, I'm not sure we have. I don't think we've taken that into account, no. I was also going to say, some of these projects have only been announced. Our projections only go through to 2019. So it's very short-term projections. Longer-term projections, of course, we keep updating as we go along.
One of the things, of course, is that public investment is important. But if you look at the overwhelming amount of investment that is happening in Asia, it's manufacturing. It's related to all these sort of trade links and global value chains that have really sort of revived again in 2017. So yes, these projects are happening, and there's even domestic projects, but I think that the other parts are much more important, economically at least. So, and you know, this the work that was done was many other authors that were involved, so I'm sure there's more details on these things in the report itself. So.
Thank you, Dr. Mercer-Blackman. We're actually out of time, a little bit over time, in fact. So let me please thank our two speakers. Everyone who joined me, just give them a round of applause. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I believe the Asian Development Outlook publication should be on the ADB's website, so I'm sure if anyone wants to look into it in more detail, it'll be readily available there. So thank you, everyone.